I was once a made member of the Colombo family in New York, one of the five mafia La Cosa Nostra families. And understand, in New York, there were so many of us where we met people. You know, we just knew how to deal with people. We knew how to get around people. We knew how to make them our friends, put our arms around them, get them to do our bidding. And they wanted to be around us. You know, we didn't have to chase them. And that extended into all walks of life, from the White House right down to the guy on the street. So, you know, after a while, they come to us and, you know, maybe they need a few extra bucks and they trusted us and we started to play the game.
Which sport specifically were you involved in?
It really crossed all sports lines. I mean, we took bets. We got involved with players and personnel. So it wasn't any one particular sport.
To your knowledge, has the mafia had influence on fixing games in these sports for the past 30 years? Baseball, basketball, football, tennis.
Yes.
And the best way to fix a basketball game, get a referee.
100%.
And you just need one.
Just need one.
In Tim Donaghy's book, Personal Foul, he claims that you guys had a few off-the-record conversations and that you had two NBA referees on your payroll in the 90s. Is that true?
Yes.
And just to confirm, neither of these refs were Tim Donaghy.
Correct.
In professional basketball, were games determined by the players, the refs, or the wise guys? I'm Tim Livingston. This is Whistleblower. Episode 2. Out of bounds. All right, let's do this thing.
Let's do it.
We're rolling.
My name is Tim Donaghy, and on July 28, 2008, I was sentenced to federal prison for betting on games I refereed.
So I'm with Tim Donaghy. I should probably tell you how I got here. Remember this phone call? Tim, what's going on? Yeah.
Hey, just wanted to give you a quick buzz. I know for a while you've been interested in doing this podcast thing that you wanted to work on, and I just started to think about it. If you're still interested, I think now would be a good time.
And that's how I got here. To Sarasota, Florida, where Tim Donaghy currently resides. When Donaghy agreed to do the podcast, my team and I scheduled the first opportunity to meet. And now, I'm sitting face to face with the most infamous referee in NBA history. A lot of these people aren't gonna know who you are. Take us through the earliest days to who you are now.
Grew up in Harrodstown, Pennsylvania, went to Cardinal Harrah High School, Villanova University. After college, started the referee and worked my way up to become an NBA basketball referee. Unfortunately, I started to gamble on the golf course, gamble playing cards, running down to the casinos and gambling and betting on college and professional football games, and eventually spilled over to betting on NBA games and then NBA games I officiated.
Rented a house for the next few days, and I'm sitting with Donaghy in the backyard, trying to get him to loosen up around a bunch of people he doesn't know. He pulled up in a new Range Rover, not the big one, the small one, but it's nice. He's dressed well, and it seems like for all that he's been through, Tim Donaghy is doing just fine. I'm hoping that my friendship with Donaghy will make him feel comfortable enough to truly open up and not just repeat his company lines. I'm hoping to get his full, uncensored story. So your average NBA fan, does he or she know the true story?
You know, I don't think so. I think people think that I was out there fixing games and doing things with the whistle to make sure star players went to the bench. I don't think they realized how the NBA had a major influence in what they wanted the referees to call on a given night. And I took that information knowing that the referee crew was gonna go out there and do certain things, and teams were at advantages and disadvantages. You know, the NBA game is more of a form of entertainment. It's not really a true athletic competition. And I think once I got to come to understand that, you know, I was better suited to be a ref in the NBA.
To hear a former NBA referee say that the NBA was entertainment rather than a true athletic competition, that's like telling a kid Santa Claus isn't real.
I mean, there was a situation with Michael Jordan. It's in Philly. They're playing on the road. He does a spin move on the baseline, and we just had come from our referee camp, and they wanted this spin move taken out of the game because they felt like it was a blatant travel. He did it, dunked the ball. I waved it off and called a travel violation on him, and 20,000 people booed me. And there was a timeout called, and Phil Jackson rushed me, and Michael Jordan rushed me and said, you know, what are you doing? And I said, what do you mean, what am I doing? You get the same training tape plays as I do. They want that call to travel. And they looked at me, and Phil Jackson said, real arrogantly, they may want that call to travel. And then he pointed at Michael Jordan. They said, but they don't want that called on him.
A rule is a rule, right? In basketball, not exactly. There's so much contact on every play that a referee could call a foul in almost every possession. Donahue's anecdote about Jordan raises the issue of referee bias and subjective enforcement of the rules. What constitutes a foul? Most of the calls in the NBA exist in a gray area. It's never black or white. Ultimately, the referees have the ability to call everything or nothing, which gives them a lot of power.
Do you remember the first game you bet on? NBA?
No. I just remember, Jack and Cannon had the Daily News. One day I was over at the country club getting ready to golf. I'd just come from home and looked at the master schedule of referees, and he flipped me the Daily News with the lines in the paper and said, you know, pick me some winners. And I rattled off three games to him. And, you know, the next day he called me laughing, you know, joking around saying, is it that easy? And I just said, yeah.
How many did you win?
3 out of 3.
Who was Jack and Cannon?
Jack and Cannon was a guy that, you know, I played golf with 3 or 4 days a week. He was the guy that when we first started to gamble, he'd put the bets in through the bookie, and we teamed up and we made plays, and he placed the bets and kind of left me out of it.
Jack and Cannon isn't affiliated with organized crime. He's not a professional gambler either. He's an insurance salesman in the Delaware County area. Kincannon has never commented publicly on the NBA betting scandal. Here's how Donahue and Kincannon started betting on NBA games.
You know, I think it's just a situation where I love to gamble out on the golf course, golfing, playing cards in the locker room, running in the casinos, and, you know, eventually just spilled over to betting college football, pro football. And eventually that day when he came to me with the Daily News, you know, the NBA, and then certain things happened, or another referee said something to me, and, you know, I thought, oh, wow, this team's going to be put in an advantage or a disadvantage. I started passing that information along to him.
Can you estimate your winning percentage during those years?
I think that we won, you know, somewhere around 80% of the time.
If winning 80% of picks sounds like a high percentage, that's because it is. The best sports gamblers in the world only win 55 to 58% of their bets. Imagine winning 4 out of every 5 blackjack hands. The only way that's possible is if you know which cards are going to be dealt. Donahue claims that his betting success relied on inside information. NBA referees are a tight fraternity. Donahue knew most of his fellow officials well. And according to him, his picks were based on which crew was assigned to which game. If referee A was going to be in Houston, bet on the Rockets, because that ref loved Yao Ming. If referee B was in Minnesota, bet against the Timberwolves, because he hated Kevin Garnett's attitude. By understanding referee biases, Donahue says he was able to look at the betting lines in the New York Daily News and win 80% of his picks. All right, but how do you actually make a pick? Before we get there, can we change with the music? There we go. The most important thing for a non-gambler to note is that in sports betting, the house wins as soon as you place a bet. A sportsbook's goal is to get even money on both sides. So if you're betting on one side, somebody else is betting the other side. The sportsbook takes its cut, also known as the vig or the juice, on every bet. So as long as the bets are even on both sides, the sportsbook makes a profit. A betting line or a spread is how sportsbooks keep the bets even. The line is how many points a team is expected to win or lose by. Here's an example. If the Knicks are 4-point favorites against the Celtics, the Knicks are expected to win the game by 4 points. In this example, if you place a bet on the Knicks and they win the game by only 3 points, you lose your bet. If you place a bet on the Knicks and they win by 5 points or more, you win your bet. 4 points, you get your money back. So Imperioli, who are you picking?
Well, I'll tell you who I'm not picking, Tim, the fucking Celtics. I'm putting my money on the Knicks. So you're probably wondering, Imperioli, how are you gonna place that bet? Well, I could go to a bookie, an actual person who'll take my money, then pay me in cash. But these guys are, not surprisingly, going extinct. In states where betting is legal, like the great state of New Jersey, I could walk into a casino, place a bet online. It's that easy. But what I'll probably do, what most people do, is bet online at a digital sports book. Some of these sites are headquartered in the US, but most are in Asia, Europe, Central America, and the Caribbean. These books are completely unregulated. The ex-con from Miami who started it doesn't even know how much money he's making. Online sports books became more prevalent during Donaghy's era and rule the roost today, but pre-internet sports betting was controlled by the wise guys. And when the mob bet big, it wasn't because they had a hunch or because they loved the Knicks. It meant they had a sure thing.
I sat down with Michael Franzis, who ran a large-scale bookmaking operation as a made man in the Colombo crime family. He explained how deep the mafia's ties went when it came to game fixing in professional sports.
Which sports specifically were you involved in?
Well, I was, I had a bookmaking operation. We had a number of bookmakers that were working for me, so it really crossed all sports lines. I mean, we took bets. We got involved with players and personnel and, so it wasn't any one particular sport, it was all of them.
It was wherever you had an in?
Yeah.
But undoubtedly, based on your experience, you would consider yourself an expert in the realm of game fixing.
I guess so, yes.
Okay. Can you go into any sort of detail about how your relationship with those referees worked?
Well, I'm not gonna mention names, but listen, in our gambling operation, it was all about the line. It's not about who wins or loses, it's about the line. And so if you have an NBA referee, the NBA basketball game's the easiest game to work with. You got 5 guys on the court and a referee controls the game. So if you got a ref working with you that can move the point spread to your advantage, that's huge. You know, in the gambling business, that's tremendous. And really that's how it worked. You know, you had a referee that was willing to, a game in the Lakers, keep Kobe Bryant on the bench for a little bit longer than he should be out there, so he can't cover the spread. It's very valuable.
So, if you had to fix a game, would you go after the star player or the referee?
Rather have the referee. Well, again, it's all about the spread. So, you know, a referee on every play, you know, he can call a foul or he don't have to call a foul. And that's what dictates the outcome of the game in many, many ways. So if you need to gain a few points, you bring a player to the foul line from the opposing team and you're gonna gain a few points, you know? And same token, if you wanna lose a few, you put their best foul shooter on the bench for a couple of points, for a couple of minutes. I mean, it's really so easy when a ref is working with you. And who's gonna, they'll get mad at him, they'll question the call, but that happens all the time anyway. So if the referee is smart, and obviously it's his ass on the line, he's gonna be smart. He just does his thing and moves on. And who's gonna know?
How did you pay the referees? Was it just a flat fee based like per game?
Yeah, they get paid in cash. Some of them had debts that they paid off that way. And others made money along with us. Yeah, we paid them. You know, if you're gonna ask me, I question every game and almost every call just by nature, because I know the way it goes. And I certainly question garbage points at the end. That's where the
money gets made.
Yeah.
So did you know a lot of referees who are living that life, who are gambling on other sports or in some form?
Referees and players, yeah. And league personnel.
Were they gambling through you guys, through your bookies?
Well, remember, back at that time, if you wanted to gamble, you had to gamble through a bookmaker.
It's not like it is today. Yeah, forgot that the shady online gambling sites did not exist.
And every bookmaker that could cover a bet was involved with us.
How much money were you moving behind a referee tip?
Oh, God knows. I mean, you got to understand, we had so many bookmakers out there. I mean, the numbers were big, really big.
In the millions?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
According to Franzis, who alleges his bookmaking operation employed multiple NBA referees, fixing an NBA game wasn't only easy, it was virtually undetectable. Because you were playing against the line, a referee could manipulate a game for 47 of 48 minutes, and if it was still close at the end, he could secure the pick with garbage points. Franzis alleges that his refs, if need be, would call a ton of fouls at the end of a game, leading to extra free throws, aka garbage points. The team that was winning the game would still win the game, but the bet would fall on the right side of the line. Nobody would have any idea the game had been fixed, and why would they? It all happened within the rules. Which begs the question, do you need to cheat to fix a basketball game? Or can you fix a game without making one technically incorrect call? Here's what Donahue had to say about fixing versus manipulating.
They're very similar, but I think fixed is you're going out there with the agenda that you're going to do everything you can and make up fictitious calls or just totally do things that aren't within the rules. But I think manipulating is within the rules. It's not wrong calls, but it's just calls that you all of a sudden decide to enforce.
But a good referee can manipulate the game within the rules.
Sure. I mean, I think any chance you got to help a player or hurt a player, you know, based on your relationship with that player, within the rules, you could do it.
This is a really important distinction. According to Donahue, fixing is when a ref is making incorrect calls, and manipulating is when a ref is not making incorrect calls. In both instances, however, a ref is influencing the game. But whether he's cheating depends on whether the calls are technically correct, manipulating, or technically incorrect, fixing.
The FBI watched all your games. What did they find after watching all of your games that you bet on?
They found that they didn't feel that I was fixing games. Of course, the NBA did an investigation and felt that I wasn't fixing games either. But, you know, that was in their best interest to say that. But when you have the FBI digging in and coming back and saying, you know, they felt like all the calls were legitimate, I think that that was one reason why Phil Scott of the FBI kind of supported me in a way, even though I did something wrong, knowing that the way the NBA conducted business, there was some things that weren't on the up and up.
According to Donahue, he was gambling on everything under the sun except for NBA games in the years preceding 2003. Then, starting in 2003, he partnered with a friend, Jack Concannon, who began placing bets on NBA games handpicked by Donahue. Things were going great until certain people caught wind of the scheme. Pro gambler Jimmy Baba Batista, who knew Donahue from high school, was one of those people. Now, Batista was a professional gambler, but his specialty was betting on games, not picking games. He sat in a war room filled with screens and placed bets for the industry's biggest sports bettors all around the world. To approach the corrupted ref, Batista recruited their mutual friend and Donahue's closest buddy, Tommy Martino, to set up a meeting. Now, Donahue had been betting on NBA games for years before that initial meeting, which took place on December 12, 2006 at the Marriott Hotel in Philadelphia. But Donahue claims that at this meeting, Batista threatened his family to get him involved. Batista denies this and says that Donahue was a willing participant. Either way, a deal was made that took the scheme from small time to the big leagues. There was only one problem. Batista was addicted to cocaine and pills and had gotten greedy. He started betting and losing his clients' money. So by the time Donahue came along, Batista was in debt, desperate, and bound to fuck it all up. Here's Donahue describing that fateful meeting with Batista and Tommy Martino.
Marriott in Philadelphia, and Tommy brings him down, not knowing that Batista was going to squeeze me, joking around, having a lot of fun. Of course, Tommy's on the phone from time to time, going to the bathroom, leaves me and Batista there by ourselves, and he flat out says to me, "Hey, Tim, you know, we're going to continue to get these picks. If not, you could be exposed to the NBA for what you've been doing in the past." In a non-little subtle way, and Tim, by the way, you don't want anyone visiting your wife and kids in Florida, do you? Let's just do this. So, you know, that's how he got me to get on board very quickly and understand that, you know, this was something that wasn't going to go away. So I jumped on board with him and was hoping at the end of this year, or that year in 2007, that it was over and we were never going to do it again. And I was going to keep my job and never bet on anything ever again, not golf, cars, nothing. That was it. It was done. But of course, that's not what happened. It was discovered over a game being a wiretap, and the rest, you know, is history. It kind of made the news a little bit.
If you would have kept this small and just worked with Jack Concannon, just worked with one person, never told anybody, would you still be reffing the NBA today?
You know, hey, if I could turn back time and say woulda, coulda, shoulda, I wouldn't have done it at all. But unfortunately, I can't do that.
After years of betting compulsively, including 4 years of betting on the NBA, the idea that Tim Donaghy was going to stop gambling after the 06-07 season seems a little hard to believe. At this point, sitting in the chair across from Donaghy, I don't believe I'm getting the full, uncensored story.
Do you remember how much money you made during your time with Tommy and Baba?
It was around $30,000. I think that's the big misconception, and that was a big holdup with you know, the prosecution. Batista's going around telling people he gave me $250,000, when in fact I never saw him again after that first game. He has the amount of games wrong. He says there was 40-some games, but there wasn't, and you, all you have to do is look at my schedule and see that from that time span, I only refereed 30 games. So there's a lot of inaccuracies that if he, you know, had half a brain, he would see that they're something that's very researchable.
Do you remember how much money you made during the run with Jack and Cannon from 03?
You know, I think with everything together over the 3.5 years, it was somewhere around $100,000, I thought.
This is the story that Donaghy tells over and over again. He bet on his own games, but he didn't fix them. And a majority of his bets were on other referees' games. Games where his inside knowledge allowed him to pick winners against the spread. And over the course of 4 seasons, he says that he only took home $100,000. Despite having the ability to win 80% of his picks, despite having the ability to print money. I spoke with Sean Patrick Griffin, professor and department head of criminal justice at the Citadel, who researched the gambling side of the scandal to write the book Gaming the Game. And the data tells a very different story.
The most common misconceptions concerning the NBA betting scandal are first and foremost that Donaghy simply bet on games as opposed to influencing them. That's the most important, I would argue. This is one of the largest scandals in U.S. sports history, and there's so much misinformation out there. And I've always said there are plenty of things we're never going to know that are he said situations. But in this story, there are plenty which are not. And let's at least get those correct. The research relies mostly on what we call primary source documents, meaning FBI files, court documents. In this modern era, people can track all sorts of data. And professional gamblers will oftentimes employ sophisticated statistical analyses, computer models, and all that stuff. Well, for the NBA betting scandal, I got access to all that stuff.
Griffin got access to the gamblers who were betting, the sportsbook managers who were taking the bets, and even some of the actual betting accounts. All the data required to solve these mysteries. What Griffin was ultimately looking for was betting line movement. When a sportsbook moves a betting line, it signals two things. One, a lot of money is being bet on that game. If the numbers aren't big, the sportsbook doesn't care. And the second thing, which is most important, it means that a lot of money is coming in on one team. This compels the sportsbook to adjust the line to encourage more bets on the other team. Remember, the goal of the sportsbook is to get even money on both sides of a betting line.
the data show is clear. The betting lines move far more on the games that Donaghy officiated than those he didn't. And there was a reason for that. Those are the games that Jimmy Batista, the pro gambler, was betting millions of dollars on, and that's what was causing the lines to move. Tim Donaghy has been very shrewd in how he has convinced a large segment of the public that he didn't fix games. If you listen to what he says a handful of staples all the time. Number one, he always says he did not make incorrect calls to influence game outcomes. That might seem trivial. That's said for a reason. That he was calling correct calls, technically correct calls, that other people either don't call or don't call nearly with the frequency which he did. And there's an irony there, by the way, because the NBA themselves said that he was one of their highest rated officials and was in the top tier when it came to the number of calls made. So if that's how you're fixing games, they're not going to get discovered. But Donaghy, when it comes to how he's influenced people to thinking that he didn't fix games, he'll always say, the FBI and the NBA each conducted thorough reviews and concluded that I didn't fix games. Well, first of all, the NBA is on record as saying we absolutely did not conclude that. And the FBI, far from concluding he didn't fix games, the FBI didn't look. And that's the fundamental problem. You need only look at the words of Supervisory Special Agent Phil Scala, who Donaghy loves quoting all the time. And he flat out says, we fought with Donaghy a lot about that. We rejected the idea that you could possibly have money riding on the outcome of a game in which you have an opportunity to influence and not have it influence your behavior. So they certainly never concluded that. But no one ever points any of these things out to him while he's live on their air. And the public is unfortunately left to hear, well, yeah, I guess if the FBI concluded, then the NBA concluded. And they didn't.
What Griffin is saying is that while the FBI did not conclude that Donaghy fixed games, they also never concluded that he didn't fix games. For reasons we'll get into later in the podcast, the FBI never had an opportunity to complete its investigation into the NBA betting scandal.
So if Donaghy was smart, could the scheme have gone on in perpetuity?
I think Donaghy was smart enough that the scandal wouldn't have been discovered if not for Jimmy Batista screwing this up for everybody, as he would tell you. By the time the scandal was ending in the spring of 2007, had a major prescription pill problem, was betting all over the place. A bunch of people by that point were told by him about the scandal. Tommy Martino, their mutual friend and co-conspirator, he had told other people, including another gambler. And that's why the betting lines were flying all over the place. And that's why the mobsters up in New York caught wind of this and were making money on it. If not for all that chaos, what Donaghy was doing was so shrewd, it never was going to get detected by the NBA, and it wasn't going to get detected by the FBI. There was nothing to detect. It was genius.
Can you quantify as best you can how much money was likely moving from 2003 to 2007?
Identifying how much money was being bet on these games is always hard. It's a murky world. I was able to document by doing a forensic analysis of Batista's betting records, there were occasions where he was betting $1 million or two on Donaghy's games himself. That alone is its own number, but then beyond that, we know that there are other people who are betting as much as they could. The number we know is in the hundreds of millions over the four seasons that were bet on this. Tim Donaghy did not know the logistics of how his bets were being placed, nor where they were being placed, by whom, or how much. Here's the thing. If inside information did account for Tim Donaghy's betting success, it wouldn't matter if he was officiating a game or not. Well, then that's a problem where all of the evidence shows all the bets were on his games, where all of his co-conspirators say that, all the pro gamblers say that, all the betting line data says that. The bets were only on his games. There's not a single person who says that other than him.
So Donaghy maintains that he was using inside information to bet primarily on other referees' games. Griffin, however, says the data makes it clear that Batista and other bettors who were betting on Donaghy's picks were only betting on games Donaghy was refereeing, games Donaghy could personally control.
Can you take us through one more time your definition of literal interpretation?
I mean, the definition of a foul or violation, how it's written in the rule book, there isn't
any gray areas there. It either is a foul or it's not a foul. It's not a situation where you're looking at the score or the time on the clock and taking that into account. You're really not supposed to do that.
So I think that's a key distinction. With your games that you bet on, you were calling the games by the rules, correct?
Right.
Who are the other referees that you were friends with that you would call to shoot the shit with and have those conversations, just trying to understand the broader NBA?
You know, Javi, Callahan, Wunderlich, Foster, Robinson, Zielinski, all those guys that we had a tight-knit bunch of people that we would just be bored and talk to each other and talk about the games.
And none of them had any idea that you were betting on games?
None.
None of them, during the games you were reffing, had any idea that you had money on these games?
Not that I'm aware of.
What does that speak to as far as the game of basketball goes?
No, I think it just shows that I was doing what the NBA wanted done and how they wanted the games called. And unfortunately for me, I took that inside information because I knew the lines were way off because of that and was able to pick the games at 80% correct.
Can a skilled referee such as yourself influence the outcome of a game without making one incorrect call?
I don't know how you would do that, influence the outcome of a game if you're not making incorrect calls.
It goes to the subjectivity of the NBA.
Right.
So, and literal interpretation.
Sure, if you know there's a situation where there's bang, bang plays, block charges, and they can go either way, and you're consistently giving it to one team, yeah, you can definitely influence the outcome of a game that way.
This is where the interview with Donahue starts to get a little contentious. You might remember earlier when I asked Donahue if a good referee can manipulate a game within the rules.
I mean, I think any chance you got to help a player or hurt a player, you know, based on your relationship with that player, within the rules, you could do it.
He answered without an issue. But now, when I ask, can a skilled referee such as yourself influence the outcome of a game without making one incorrect call? I get pushback. Last year, your best friend Tommy Martino wrote a book about the scandal titled Inside Game. In it, he said, "I also want the world to know what really happened in the 3 months during which we rewrote the book on influencing professional
sports. I'm going to stop short of saying fixing, because there's a fine line between fixing and influencing. The question of fixing is for Tim Donaghy only. And in my eyes, if he were fixing, he would have won all the games he gave us. Tim told me he could influence a game 6 points either way.
Take that as you wish, but that's what he told me." What do you say to that?
I don't ever recall saying that to him, and I don't know why he wrote it in the book.
Okay.
Do you agree with what Tommy said regarding the fine line between fixing and manipulating?
Yeah, I mean, I've always said, you know, fixing is different than manipulating the game, and I felt like that's what the NBA did, and that's what a lot of the referees did, was manipulate the game. I think if you were out fixing the games, you would have put the star players to the bench on phantom calls to make sure their team was at a major disadvantage.
Fixing, manipulating. Much like foul calls, these concepts are also subjective. The data strongly suggests that Donahue fixed games, but outside of a confession, he'll always be able to deny it. Fixing games doesn't have to be obvious. You don't have to put a star player on the bench. You can fix a game subtly. As Michael Franzese said, it can be virtually undetectable. So, how do we cut through the noise to find clear answers in the story?
What was your working relationship like with Tommy?
I mean, what's there not to like about Tommy? You know, he's the guy that has anything you need, and everybody likes him, and it's just, every time you were with him, it was just a barrel of laughs.
I met Tommy a few times before, and it's true. He's the life of the party. If you've seen Goodfellas, he's Joe Pesci, minus the temper. I knew we'd interview Tommy at some point, but Donahue insisted that we fly him down to Sarasota. More than anything, even though their stories are sometimes at odds, I think Tim just wanted an excuse to hang out with his buddy.
Italian.
Yeah. Tommy Martino. Yeah. Hey.
So, the game last night.
Oh, yeah. So, I know the bookmakers killed it on that game.
Yeah.
Because everybody had San Francisco. So, everybody bet San Fran last night. They thought that they were going to kill Seattle.
Right.
But I like the points.
Most
part. Yeah, and did you watch the whole game to see how Seattle, when it was going in at halftime? And they...
The next morning, our crew was setting up to interview Tommy when Donahue announced that he had to leave for a doctor's appointment. Already mic'd up, Tommy and I started talking.
This is good that Tim left.
I agree. When he said he had a doctor's appointment this time of the day, I was like, perfect. Tommy, no distractions.
Yep.
There's certain things that Tim says that we have to examine objectively. There's some things that I believe are unequivocally 100% true.
I believe it.
All the stuff with the scandal and your guy and what you guys...
He fabricates a lot. Like the amount of money he got and shit.
You know, with Tim, it's, you know, he wants everything to be told a certain way.
Right.
And he's been doing it for 10 years,
that's
and I get it.
He's got to stick by it. That's what he told the feds. He doesn't want to look like a liar.
The point of this is not to prove that Tim fixed games. Like, that's not, I think what's interesting is looking at the influencing games versus fixing games. That is interesting, right? Because that's what I asked him at the end. Can you influence a game by reffing by the rule book? And the answer is yeah. Yeah. That's fucking interesting. Yeah. It's not his fault that the NBA is that subjective, right?
So, Tim, influencing, he used to tell me that, like, if he saw somebody's foot close to the inline, he'd blow the whistle. It was for our team that we had. Is that influencing or is that fixing, Tim?
Close to or on? Was it close?
Close. If it was our guy, it was on.
Well, I think that's where it gets interesting, right?
I can never say you fixed him. Is that influencing or fixing?
If you're taking Tim by his definition, then I think that would be fixing. Right?
Right.
Whistleblower is a production of Tenderfoot TV and Whistleblower Media in association with Cadence 13. Donald Albright and Payne Lindsay are executive producers on behalf of Tenderfoot TV. Myself and Doug Matica are creators and executive producers on behalf of Whistleblower Media. Our co-executive producer is Cole Ocasio. Our lead producer is Alex Vespisted. Co-producers are Mason Lindsay, Matt Keller, and Paul Kasheri. Sound design, mixing, and mastering by Cooper Skinner. Original music is by Makeup and Vanity Set. Cover design and illustration by Mr. Soul. Special thanks to Oren Rosenbaum and Grace Royer at UTA, Ryan Nord and the Nord Group, Beck Media and Marketing, Station 16, Paul Anderson and Nick Pinella of Workhouse Media, Max Hacker and John Bagakis, the teams at Tenderfoot TV and Cadence 13, and to Michael Imperioli. Check out his new podcast, Talking Sopranos, wherever you get your podcasts. Lastly, thank you to Liz Livingston and Tali Ravid for your invaluable insights and for never letting us give up on this story. For more information about the podcast, visit whistleblowerpod.com. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, 5 stars preferably, and review. Thanks.